Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, to mark the feast of St. Andrew, Pope Benedict sends a message to the Ecumenical Patriarch, highlighting the urgent need for a common witness of faith. To mark World AIDS Day, we hear from the Caritas Internationalis Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS about a church-run project in Vietnam providing hope to hundreds of women and children in need. And exploring the Anglican patrimony, the chairman of the Church of England Liturgical Commission explains why common worship should remain at the heart of our ecumenical engagement. Since 1988, December the 1st has been observed each year as World AIDS Day, highlighting the need to keep up the fight against this global pandemic. Though much progress has been made over the past two decades in protection against the HIV virus and care for people and communities affected by it, there are still over 33 million people around the world living with the virus today. While antiretroviral drugs have saved millions of young lives, there are still too many places where stigma, fear, poverty or discrimination are preventing people from coming forward for vital testing, support and treatment. In many countries, the churches and other faith communities are in the front line in providing such care and support, especially in the most isolated communities. Father Bob Vitillo, the Caritas Internationalis Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS, has just returned from a visit to Vietnam, where he saw firsthand the dramatic difference one church project, the House of Hope in Ho Chi Minh City, is making to the lives of hundreds of women and children in need.
A number of dioceses continue their work on HIV and AIDS. And I think that most of the church people in Vietnam would agree with me that the Archdiocese of Ho Chi Minh City really started this work and has shared a great deal of its experiences with many other dioceses now as well. I was in Ho Chi Minh City once again on this trip and visited some of the projects that the Archdiocese is working on, especially a program for women and children called the My Tom Center. My Tom means the love of the Mother of God, and you certainly see the love of our Blessed Mother and of the Church in this program. Father John Twy, a young chameleon father, accepts women who are living with HIV. Many of them have been abused women, have been drug users or the partners of drug users, and some were involved in sex work as well. They found themselves infected. They were rejected by their families. A number of them already had children or were pregnant, and the My Tom Center has given them a place to live, a place to be loved, a place to get treatment for their illnesses, including antiretroviral treatment, and then a place where they could begin to start a whole new life. And so I visited a flower shop that was started by Father John and the women, and they're doing very, very well. They make flower arrangements not only for the local people, but then also for some of the businesses in Ho Chi Minh City. The day that I went there, they had already sold out of flowers, and it was only at 10 in the morning. So they were very proud of their accomplishments that day and other days. I then visited a sewing program that the women are doing. And then a number of health clinics that have been started by the same Archdiocese of Ho Chi Minh City, where some of the people living with AIDS have been trained to be nurses' aides and nurses, and they've gotten their licenses to be nurses. And they're now helping the people coming in with AIDS and with other illnesses.
Stigma around HIV and AIDS is still a huge problem, though, isn't it, in Vietnam? How are you helping, perhaps, to try and break through that taboo, as it were?
Well, one way is to try to help people get a profession for themselves and be able to work and feel better about themselves. Then they're more willing to share their own life experiences with others. Then at the opposite end of that whole spectrum is the fact that Father John will take in these women. And also, when I went there just a couple of days before, a child had been abandoned in front of the house. So it kind of shows the total stigma and rejection of people with AIDS, but then also also people who are able to build a new life project for themselves. And then there's the whole thing in between, the fact that Father John has worked very hard to get the children into schools. Sometimes the other students and the parents of other students don't know that they're living with HIV, but just the fact that they could be educated and not just hidden in the shelter, but also now being able to go to school and being able to enter into society. The newest project that they're starting in the Archdiocese of Ho Chi Minh City is to bring some of the adolescents who are living with HIV to a new center, an independent living center. So already trying to prepare for the fact that these children will live. They're getting treatment now and prepare them for independent living in the future.
Let's look then at this World AIDS Day 2011. The theme is looking ahead to a zero generation, isn't it? Zero
Yes.
new infections. Isn't this a bit of a, well, utopian dream?
Well, in a way, it is a utopian dream, but unless we articulate the dream, then it's harder to build some benchmarks to get there. And so the whole thrust of the long-range plan now of UNAIDS is zero new infections, zero children born with HIV, zero deaths due to HIV, and zero stigma. And so I think that's very much what has helped to shape this theme of World AIDS Day. And actually, the dream is more realizable now than it was 25 or even 10 years ago, because we have made good progress with getting access to medicines for many people, although we still have more than 10 million people who need that access. And also, we have the means to stop new infections among children. We simply have to make sure that more pregnant women who are living with HIV get access to the medicines that they need to be able to prevent the transmission from mother to child. So it's more a possibility now, and we need to articulate it and then work toward accomplishing it.
Here at Caritas, you're working particularly with this mother-to-child transmission, aren't you? The project that you launched a couple of years ago. How successful has that been? Where are you seeing most results in this work?
Well, the Caritas Heart for Children campaign was launched in 2009, and we've had very good participation from Caritas and other Catholic organizations that are interested in this campaign for early treatment and diagnosis of children living with HIV, and then for better uptake and access to the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And we've had a number of Caritases take advocacy action with pharmaceutical companies to encourage that they continue the research and development of pediatric dosages for HIV medicines so that children living with HIV can live and look forward to a long life. And then also trying to work with governments and pharmaceutical companies to try to undo the obstacles for pregnant women to learn of their infection earlier and then to both receive the simple medicines to prevent the actual transmission during the birth process, but then also to get onto medicines so that they won't transmit the virus when they're breastfeeding their children, and also that they'll be living to take care of their children, that they won't die due to AIDS-related illnesses when their children are quite young.
Stigma is still a key to this, isn't it? Because in so many places, women still are not able or unwilling to come forward to be tested. They're afraid of being thrown out of their homes. How do you really make significant progress in this area today?
Well, one way is certainly to be sure that governments not only have laws against stigma and discrimination toward people living with HIV, but they implement those laws. The next way is to try to influence people to change their own attitudes and behaviors toward people who are living with HIV. And I think that the church has a key role to play in that. And so in a lot of the workshops that I facilitate with clergy and religious, especially with the clergy, we actually practice how to give homilies about HIV, how to make sure that we animate within the Christian community a community of love and acceptance rather than of placing blame or rejection on people. And then also the more people who know that there's a chance to be able to have access to treatment and therefore to live even though they're living with HIV, then they're more willing to come out and to be tested and to learn early of their infection and then to be able to be integrated within the wider community and talk about their situation. So all those are ways to try to eliminate stigma.
You focus very much, this is the heart of the work that you do, and yet at international level, perhaps the whole question of HIV/AIDS has really fallen off the news agenda, hasn't it? It's not seen as an urgent priority anymore, particularly at a time like this of economic recession.
There's a great fear that that more and more governments will not pay so much attention to HIV and will cut back the funding. And we've seen some of that already. Last year, Caritas Internationalis joined some other Catholic organizations to do a study of the impact on AIDS funding cutbacks and flatlining on our own church programs in developing countries. And in fact, then we took the opportunity to have a side event at the latest high-level meeting on AIDS that took place at UN headquarters in New York in June of 2011 to reveal the feedback that we received and to actually have people giving witness to the way those cutbacks have affected their programs. And that then we used as a platform to influence governments to stay fully committed on their commitment to give funding for AIDS programs. You know, I've had many church programs turn to me now and say, you can convinced us that we had to start antiretroviral treatment programs. You told us to get started because the funding was available and it was a way of saving lives. But now these governments are pulling back their funding, and yet we have the obligation to keep these people on medicine for life. And so it puts us in a real dilemma, and we need to keep up the international advocacy and pressure for governments to respect their commitments.
Part of the problem also for Caritas was that governments simply weren't willing to recognize just how much the church was doing in so many countries around the world. Do you think that we're winning that battle at all yet?
I think that we're making progress with the battle. I'm not sure we're winning it yet, but we have made progress. More and more, there's a recognition of the role that faith-based organizations play. Certainly, we've had the director of UNAIDS, Michel Sidibe, publicly acknowledge that, both at meetings at the Vatican, but also then to his own board at UNAIDS to say how much the churches are doing. Recently, I was appointed as a member of a steering group for the new global plan to eliminate new infections among children by 2015 and to keep their mothers alive and healthy. And I was specifically appointed as a member of that steering group, which is a very small group of people, as a representative of civil society and faith-based organizations. So I think it is a way of acknowledging how much churches and other religious groups are doing.
You say churches. You work very much across an ecumenical alliance also, don't you?
Yes, I am very active, and several of the Catholic organizations are very active in the Ecumenical Advocacy Alliance, which is based in Geneva, Switzerland, and which helps faith-based organizations learn how to do advocacy on these key issues related to HIV and AIDS. Of course, we work together with them as Catholic organizations on areas where we have agreement, and yet there are certain areas that we don't agree, and so then we certainly follow the teaching of the church in that regard.
Each time I ask you this question, but over the past year or so, what kind of stories, what kind of people have you met perhaps who give you most hope that there really is the possibility of an AIDS-free world?
Well, I meet the people who are living with HIV, but are living and living positively and living a life to the full. In this last trip to Vietnam, I met a man who was a drug user, was imprisoned in a drug rehabilitation center in Vietnam, was dying, literally dying, and he recovered because of the love that the Catholic Church gave him in that center. The sisters didn't want to see him go back into the regular prison, and so they trained him to be a nurse's aide in the hospice they were running in that prison. And eventually he finished his term, and now he's a nurse's aide in one of the clinics being run by the Archdiocese of Ho Chi Minh City. And the moment I walked in, he looked at me and he said, "You came to visit me." And that was 5 years ago. But he remembered that I had gone to that prison, and that meant something to him. But then, you know, I reminded him of the great good that he's doing now. In the program for children that's being run in the Archdiocese of Ho Chi Minh City, I met a nurse, fully qualified qualified nurse who literally was on her deathbed, but she got access to medicines because of that church program. And then the church worked very, very hard and at many odds to get her accepted into nursing school and to be licensed as a nurse. And she's now the nurse in this home for mothers and babies with AIDS. That makes me really get the hope that they can have a new life, and not only that they're now enjoying life for themselves, but they're dedicating their lives now to helping other people.
And also helping to bring the church's values into the heart of society, because particularly if you're talking about Vietnam, so often the church has a very difficult time trying to make its rights respected.
The church does have a very difficult time, and yet, again, when you talk to the people who are living with HIV, they want to go to those church programs because they know that there's a love that drives those programs that they cannot find in many of the public hospitals or even some of the private hospitals that are not church-related. And I think that very much connects with the message that our Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, has been giving to us about charity, that charity is not just something that's a philosophical principle, and it's not just being good professionals, although certainly the church's charitable workers need to be good professionals as well, but it's driven by a love of Jesus and a personal relationship with Jesus that then is translated into the love that we feel from God into our own love for other people.
My thanks there to Father Bob Vitillo, the Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to Caritas Internationalis, the Global Confederation of Catholic Aid and Development Agencies. Catholics and Orthodox face exactly the same challenges in the cultural, social, economic, political, and ecological spheres. Faced with the urgency of these tasks, we have the duty to show the world that we are people of a mature faith, people who, despite our tensions, are capable of working together in the common search for truth and unity. That's the message at the heart of a letter sent by Pope Benedict XVI to the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I to mark Wednesday's Feast of St. Andrew, patron saint of the Orthodox world. The letter, written in French, was presented to the Patriarch in the Turkish capital, Istanbul, by a delegation from the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, headed by Cardinal Kurt Koch, its president. After greeting all the Orthodox clergy and faithful, the Pope recalls his recent meeting with Patriarch Bartholomew in Assisi during the Day of Reflection for Peace and Justice in the World. Noting that the Patriarch is celebrating the 20th anniversary of his ministry as spiritual leader of the Orthodox world, Pope Benedict stresses that the future of evangelization depends upon the united witness and the quality of love shown by the one church which Christ willed for all his followers. He says it is a great source of comfort to see that the Patriarch also has at the heart of his ministry that same search for holiness and united witness which today's secular societies so urgently need. Anglican patrimony was the term used by the authors of Anglicanorum Caetibus, the Apostolic Constitution, or founding document of the Ordinariate for former Anglicans wishing to enter into full communion with the Holy See. That document, published in November 2009, speaks about allowing the use of liturgical books proper to the Anglican tradition, which have been approved by the Holy See, so as to maintain the liturgical, spiritual, and pastoral traditions of the Anglican community. Communion, in short, the Anglican patrimony within the Catholic Church. In England, the first ordinariate, known as Our Lady of Walsingham, was established in January 2011, while other requests are currently under consideration for groups in Australia, Canada, and the United States. But what exactly does that term Anglican patrimony really mean, and how easily can it be uprooted and transferred from one tradition to another? Well, in an effort to answer that question, the Anglican Centre here in Rome recently held the second in a series of colloquia, inviting experts in liturgical, spiritual and pastoral formation to explore what it might mean for both communities. Among the key speakers at the November 17th encounter on liturgical patrimony was Bishop Stephen Platten of Wakefield, chairman of the Church of England Liturgical Commission and former ecumenical secretary to two of the previous Archbishops of Canterbury.
We
we're here talking about this question of the Anglican patrimony. It's a term that you don't really like at all, do you? Can you explain why?
Well, I don't like it really because in the end, I think it's a mistaken concept really for us. There's no doubt about it that there is something about Anglicanism which is distinctive and which I much enjoy and cherish. But what I don't think there is something that you can somehow cut off as a sort of a chunk of something and then say, that's Anglican patrimony and we'll go and take it over here. Because it seems to me it's part of an entire sort of fabric and way of living and worshipping. So it's not something you can sort of take away as an annex to something else.
You prefer the term matrimony, don't you? Talking in a very sort of symbolic way also about the engagement between the two churches.
Yes, because what is undoubtedly true is that there is an enormous amount of tradition which we hold in common. The amount we don't hold in common is relatively small in comparison or in contrast to that. And one of the great moments, of course, was when Pope Paul VI met Archbishop Michael Ramsay. And during their meeting, the Holy Father took off his episcopal ring and gave it to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who then wore it thereafter. And every time archbishops come to Rome now, they wear that same ring. And someone, I thought rather cleverly, some years ago now, likened this to the engagement between our two churches. And of course, that engagement is true on two levels. It's true on the symbolic level of getting engaged and therefore perhaps looking forward to matrimony. But it's also true in the sense that we've engaged with each other now for whatever it is, 40 years through Archic 1, Archic 2, and now Archic 3. And I realise I'm perfectly realistic about the fact that there are problems at present in terms of us moving closer together. But we are in some sense betrothed. And that means that we can't let each other go. And people often say to me, why do you bother with Archic when it's perfectly clear that from both angles, from the Roman Catholic and Anglican, there are great difficulties? And I always say to them, well, first of all, it's a conversation, and whoever would want to break off a conversation? And secondly, we have things to learn from each other. There's a great term which has been coined recently called receptive ecumenism, and the idea is that one has something to offer others and they have things to offer you. In some ways, it's hardly a new discovery, because that's what we've been at all the time. But it does seem to me a very positive way of looking at it. And I think, you know, we do have things which each can contribute to the other communion.
As you say, though, you've been very involved in Archic. Public perception is that, in a sense, we're now going backwards, that the progress of the previous years has come to a grinding halt. And many also see this new ordinariate as yet another spoke in the wheel, if you like.
Well, I think I wouldn't say we're going backwards. I think what I would say is that we have slowed up significantly, but huge amounts have been achieved. I think people fail to remember what things were like 25, 30, 50 years ago. When I was a child, I remember going to a wedding and I said to my mother, now where's Auntie Wynne? I said, she normally comes to all these family gatherings. Ah, she can't come because she's a Roman Catholic. Now, if you said that to someone now, they'd sort of almost burst out laughing or think you'd lost your mind. So we have made huge progress. But significantly, there are difficulties, and we all know what they are. And I think it is true to say that the establishment of the Ordinariate has not been, I think, in most people's eyes, a fillip to ecumenism, because it seems to misunderstand what we're about when we're trying to draw closer to each other. It isn't an obvious example of receptive ecumenism, where we try and offer each other something. It feels much more like someone saying, oh, well, come back to the fold and then it'll all be all right. And I can understand why people might want to become Roman Catholics, and I can understand why sometimes Roman Catholics become Anglicans. There are good reasons for doing that. But it seems to me that the Ordinariate doesn't add anything to that. And that's why, again, the word patrimony seems to me to be not a very helpful word. It's a sort of way of saying, well, you know, you can come and you can bring with you a package of stuff. But as I've already hinted, that package of stuff is not like that. It's something about a way of life, a way of worshipping, which is integral to itself.
As you say, it is, of course, a 500-year tradition that has grown up around these very defining elements. But if you had to point to what you see as perhaps the most significant elements of this Anglican liturgy, what would it be?
I suppose the first thing to say is, of course, that it was one of the first vernacular liturgies. So people were able to understand what was being said in their own language. And I think that accent on vernacular is very important, because one of the things that people treasure is the language that was coined by Thomas Cranmer. After all, much of what he was using was translating stuff which is common in the Western tradition. So if there is a patrimony and people want to use that word, as I say, I wouldn't normally use it, but if you want to use that word, or just, I'd want to say there's a common tradition. And what Cranmer did was to actually take that tradition and translate it into the vernacular and to refashion it in a way that made it usable by a much broader group of people. So one of the extraordinary things he did was to take the monastic offices, effectively the Benedictine offices, with the help of Cardinal Ximenes from Spain, so I mean Roman Catholic tradition again, and he fashioned it into a morning office and an evening office. All Anglican clergy are, by law, canon law, required to say the morning and evening office daily. But Cranmer wanted more than that. He felt that by boiling it down into these two marvellous classical offices, lay people might use it too. So there's been that tradition. And there has also been an almost unbroken tradition of singing the office in our cathedral churches. Now, one of the key things about all this is that the Book of Common Prayer and its derivatives have been hugely important in the fashioning of society in England. So there is really something quite significant in what Cranmer and his inheritors have offered us.
Do you think if we're looking in terms of sharing these gifts rather than perhaps taking over from one communion to the other, but if there is a renewed interest in perhaps sharing these liturgical gifts, do you think it can act as a real spur to the ecumenical movement?
I think it can, and I think one of the things we had a very good discussion here in the Anglican Centre talking about all these things, and one of the things that it can do is to remind us that what is absolutely at the heart of our Christian faith is worship. That's where we ought to begin and end. And if we spend a little more time focusing upon worship, there could be some considerable fruits and benefits for our relationship with each other as churches. So I think in that respect, and so it's like all these things, I wouldn't have chosen the word patrimony, as you quite rightly said. But the fact that we've actually been sitting around talking about it has, I think, helped us to learn something from each other. And the three of us who have been speaking today on this subject have all contributed quite different things. And when we then engage with a larger group of people, we do have things to offer each other. And I'm really pleased that it is the liturgy, it's worship, that is the place from which we started.
My thanks to Anglican Bishop Stephen Platten, Chairman of the Church of England Liturgical Commission. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.